degree in history and is currently working on her doctoral degree in philosophy at UCLA. She's widely published and has produced a film called Reflections, a film about women. She's currently writing a book on the history of the office of the presiding patriarch of the church with E. Gary Smith. Our commentator, who has not arrived, did not give me any information about her, so all I know is that she is Heather Houston Rossett, who is currently receiving, she's a PhD candidate in English at the University of Chicago. I have one announcement to make before we begin. There are a few more banquet tickets available, but they must be purchased after this session today, or you won't be able to receive them at all. They're going to cut off sales. So, well, now continue.
The actual title of this paper is Patriarchal Blessings as Reflections of Change in Mormon Culture. The other sounded more trendy, I suppose. Copies of all patriarchal blessings are deposited in the office of the church historian, and dating from 1834, which is the first one I have, to the present day, they could afford a rich, valuable picture of cultural change in the church, one which might also be reflective of change in the American society as a whole. In the interest of privacy, however, the church does not allow access to these blessings unless there is proof of a blood relationship. As a researcher, then, one has to be content with those blessings published in journals or other records, and any that individuals may choose to release. All of the more than 400 blessings upon which this study is based are drawn from these sources, and this paper is about a third of the material that I have for that chapter. Apostle John A. Witzo cautioned the saints, "Since the patriarchs are but men, they are subject to human frailties. Their manner of speech and thinking is reflected in their blessings. Almost inescapably, then, these expressions will reflect the context of the particular social, economic, and religious climate in which the church itself is operating at any given time." Sidney Ahlstrom, in his American Religious History, said of Mormonism, "The movement yields innumerable clues to the religious and social consciousness of the American people." So even with the limited sample of patriarchal blessings available, it is possible to see quite startling changes in the presuppositions that underlie not only our Mormon culture, but American society as a whole. The purpose of this paper is to illustrate some of those changes as seen in patriarchal blessings, first by showing subtle adaptations in seemingly constant themes, secondly by giving examples of phrases now becoming obsolescent, and third, by addressing the changes in administrative policies relating to blessings. Finally, I'd like to pull all the threads together and make some philosophical observations of my own as I have dealt with the questions that this study has raised for me. One aspect of patriarchal blessings has remained constant through 150 years and more, the declaration of lineage. Most people are assigned to the tribe of Ephraim and a few to Manasseh, or simply through Joseph, and there are a few others. I'd be very interested, by the way, in speaking with anyone whose tribe is different. Despite the constancy with which tribal connections are named, what has changed has been the interpretation of what those declarations mean. Early phrases, not so often seen today, suggest a heritage of blood line, as expressed in the words, "You are through the loins of Ephraim," or "Thou art of the blood of Joseph." One particular blessing refers to the priesthood power and authority being confined to, quote, "that royal stock and noble blood that was not allowed to mingle among the nations in order to preserve the purity of the sanctuary of the Lord and the holy priesthood from adulteration," end of quote. As late as 1929, the patriarch said, "Those who are leaders in Israel, no matter where they come from, are of Ephraim, while the blood of Manasseh is found in the tribes and nations of the Indians of North and South America." A recent letter to Sunstone magazine tells of an incident where an American Indian member on a mission, encountered the surprise of a local patriarch that she had been assigned to the tribe of Ephraim, whereas her Anglo companion had been told her blessings would be through Manasseh. In 1836, Elijah Abel, a black convert, was given a blessing by Joseph Smith Sr. Although he was not assigned any specific lineage, the patriarch did tell him that he would be made equal to thy brethren, a promise that was particularly dangerous in that time. Today, most black members of the church are, as far as I know, assigned to the tribe of Ephraim, as are most white members. Although there are still a few blessings that denote a blood relationship with the designated tribe, today's scientific discoveries, together with an awakening social conscience and a growing familiarity with all races on an individual level, have brought changes in interpretation. Patriarch Eldred G. Smith's reply to questions of lineage makes that quite clear. A 1961 letter addressed to him had pointed out that 10 of the 12 tribes had been cited in blessings, according to the church historian's records, as well as 15 other lineages. Personally, I've only come across 6 tribes. In response to these questions about pure lineage, the patriarch declared, "We are all mixtures. There is no such thing, as far as I've been able to determine, as any one of us being just one lineage and no other mixture in our genealogy at all. So it is the right of the patriarch to declare which line through which the blessings will come." In other words, he's giving blessings, not declaring lineage. We still do get declarations of lineage, but there has been a change in how we interpret it. Perhaps the most dramatic illustration of cultural change seen in 20th century patriarchal blessings is the almost total elimination of references to an imminent millennium, so common in the 19th century. Millennial expectations were not simply a Mormon phenomenon then. Such a belief was strong throughout the new nation in the early 19th century, and the revolution itself was seen as preparing the way for the second coming. But for Mormons, that hope received concrete affirmation in many of the blessings. A number of recipients were promised, "Thou shalt stand in the flesh and witness the winding up scene of this generation," or, "Thou shalt remain on earth to behold thy Savior come in clouds of glory." Many, including 2 women, were blessed that they would be among the 144,000 to stand on Mount Zion, despite the fact that we believe that this reference in Revelation refers to 144,000 high priests. There were blessings which encouraged members in the most militant terms to play their part in overcoming the wicked during the last days. For example, the nephew of the patriarch John Smith was told, "If thou wilt seek after knowledge and be sober-minded, thou shalt be like Mormon of old, and be a mighty man in the ministry and a mighty warrior. Thou shalt handle the sword of Laban with such power as to put 10,000 of thine enemies to flight with the help of thy brother, and thy name shall be terrible among thine enemies. Thou shalt live to see Israel gathered from the 4 quarters of the earth, and to see all the enemies of the Lord swept from off the earth." Another was told, "Thou shalt be a mighty man in Israel, and when the remnant of Jacob shall go through among the Gentiles, or a lion among the flocks of sheep, you shall be captain over thousands, shall tread down and destroy, and none shall deliver them out of your hands." Several blessings state, "Thou art numbered with the horns of Joseph, for thou shalt push people together." That really intrigued me for a while, until I discovered that it comes from Deuteronomy in the Old Testament, and there are several meanings to that term. Such expressions disappeared from blessings at the beginning of the 20th century, as far as I know, just as expectations of an early millennium died out in the American nation. Other prophetic statements that were common in the 19th century have also disappeared in the current, more skeptical age. Oliver Huntington in 1836 received the promise that he would preach to the inhabitants of the moon or the planets. In the scientific world of the late 18th century, it was believed that there was life on the moon, and both Brigham Young and Hiram Smith believed that that was the case. And who knows but what that day may yet come. But it will be a resurrected Oliver Huntington who preaches to them. During the early days of the church, there were many other predictions that may appear quite strange to us today. Recipients were promised that they would have power to command the waters or cause the earth to tremble. I live in California, and I'm glad I don't have that. At thy command, the waters shall be divided, or at thy word, the wind shall be stayed. Some of the saints, including a few women, were told that they would be able to do any mighty miracle in the name of the Lord. And men were advised they could command the raging of the sea, and it shall be still, cause streams to break forth in dry places, shall be able to feed thousands in time of famine by the prayer of faith. One other practice, advocated by the prophet himself in 1839 and seen in several patriarchal blessings, was the use of healing objects. This was probably inspired by the story of Paul in Acts, who sent a handkerchief he had blessed to heal the people. Several journals reveal that Patriarch Joseph Smith Sr. blessed church members such as newly baptized Lorenzo Snow, quote, that he should have power when not able to visit the sick to send his handkerchief to them, and that the afflicted by touching it should be made whole. 19th century recipients were promised that they would be translated, that they should never be brought down to the grave, or you shall not taste of death, but shall be changed in the twinkling of an eye. All of these examples may seem outlandish or extravagant to us today, but they were in tune with the evangelical climate of the first half of the 19th century. Mormons, despite their many peculiar beliefs, were still creatures of their time and place. And in view of the terrible privation and persecution they had to endure, those blessings must have provided a great deal of comfort. Yet, there persisted, despite the sufferings of the saints, a belief in turning the other cheek. John D. Lee, for example, later executed for his part in the Mountain Meadows massacre, was told in his 1838 patriarchal blessing, "Thou shalt come forth in the morning of the first resurrection, and no power shall hinder, except the shedding of innocent blood or the consenting thereto." But this attitude changed with the increased violence and persecution meted out to the saints with their every move. It is no wonder that many blessings assured the victims that the Lord would punish the aggressors, or at least give the victims the opportunity to avenge their indignities and sufferings. After Joseph and Hiram were murdered, this desire for revenge became more focused, with expressions in patriarchal blessings such as that they would be given the power to avenge the blood of the prophets. One very significant blessing was given to William H. Dame, a church leader involved in the discussions prior to the 1857 Mountain Meadows massacre. In February 1854, he was told, "Thou shalt be called to act at the head of a portion of thy brethren and of the Lamanites in the redemption of Zion, and the avenging of the blood of the prophets. The angel of vengeance shall be with thee." Recent blessings have been more conciliatory. In fact, there has been a shift in a conservative direction that betrays the church's growing need for acceptance in the larger society. Young men entering into college in the 1960s and 1970s were advised in their blessings to play their part in putting down civil protests, to support the president of this country and his cabinet, and to condemn rebellions of all kinds. There is also emphasis on sustaining the institutional church by attending meetings and supporting church programs, on living virtuous lives, and in the case of women, there is an increasing celebration of the ideal domestic life, with women being a shining light of inspiration to husbands and children. Blessings given to women during the early days of Mormonism serve to illustrate the significant changes that have occurred through time. In many of the 19th century patriarchal blessings bestowed on women, they were empowered to heal the sick by the laying on of hands. Others were told they would be able to do any miracle which shall be for the health and happiness of your family. These promises are understandable given the fact that men were often absent on missions and the sisters needed to feel empowered. Yet women were also told that they should obey their husbands and that he was to be their savior or deliverer. During the days when polygamy was a secret, if suspected, practice, at least seven blessings and mentioned strange questions troubling the minds of the women. One woman was told, "The devil has sought to ensnare thee and bind thy soul fast because of strange questions that have arisen. Thy spirit has been troubled, but the purpose of God cannot fail, and the time shall come when thou shalt see it and understand it, and thy soul shall be comforted." Another was reassured, "Although thy fears have troubled thee, and doubts have arisen because of strange questions that have troubled thee, this has become a matter of talk and conversation between thee and thy husband. Yet because of the integrity of his heart, and because of thy desires to do right, thou hast made thyself content and desired to become reconciled to thy fate and to the will of God." The women were assured that if they would abide by the law of the Lord, their glory should be like the bright stars of the firmament or the sun in its meridian glory, for none shall outshine thee in all the heavenly kingdom or be made more glorious in their place. Two early patriarchal blessings were, quote, "to seal the blessings of thy mother upon thee." One talks about fulfilling thy mother's purpose, and another states, "There is a reward in heaven laid up for you, and the key is your mother." These blessings are particularly intriguing. Are they referring to an earthly mother or to mother in heaven? So far, I have not encountered any such phrasing in 20th century blessings. The only patriarchal blessing bestowed for the dead I have come across was bestowed on a woman. There have been changes in interpretation here also. A common phrase that continues to appear in blessings today is, "You shall be known as a mother in Israel." In earlier days, this significance derived less from the physical fact of giving birth than it did from the quality of a woman's service in God's kingdom. During this same period, in England, the phrase was used to describe women preachers who were devoted to the cause, and it was deemed a more honorable title than sister. In early Mormonism, too, it describes particularly valiant women. Our current Relief Society manual concedes this larger meaning of the term in patriarchal blessings. It says, "To be a mother in Israel in the full gospel sense is the highest reward that can come into the life of a woman. This designation has a deep and significant meaning, one that is far more than marrying and bearing children in this life, great as important and important as that course is." But then the lesson goes on to say, "In the full and true sense of the word, the blessing of being mothers in Israel shall come in due course to some who, through no fault of their own, are denied the opportunity to marry and bear children in this life." And the lesson continues to concentrate on our obligation to be good mothers. In teaching this lesson, I recognized that most sisters in the class saw the phrase in that light, as a reminder of the blessings of motherhood and the promise that those not so blessed in this life would someday become a mother in the biological sense. Blessings given to women in recent years have urged them to be content with their divinely appointed sphere, yet in some instances they have been encouraged to pursue greater knowledge and education. One so far unique blessing tells the recipient that she should, quote, "not be in a hurry to marry, but should gain an education." Changes have taken place in the policies governing the bestowal of patriarchal blessings. They too reflect changes in our Mormon culture. During the tenure of Joseph Smith Sr., blessing meetings were held where everyone gathered together in celebration, and in which recipients and relatives enjoyed, quote, "a rich repast with all the bounties of nature." This is in sharp contrast to the privacy accompanying the giving of patriarchal blessings today. During early Shia survival days, patriarchs were paid for their services. The amounts varied from the $10 per week, a lot in those days, first paid to Joseph Smith Sr. out of church funds, to the later $1 or $2 paid directly to the patriarch by the recipient. Another custom is evidence in the High Council trial of Isaac MacWithey, charged with want of benevolence to the poor and charity to the church. During the proceedings, Patriarch Joseph Smith Sr. says that he blessed the accused with a patriarchal blessing, but thinks that he received nothing for him from the poor, as was usual for him on such occasions. Then in the late 1800s, when the value of private enterprise was enjoying its unregulated heyday in America, John Taylor expressed some concern about the practices of patriarchs in a letter he wrote to George Q. Cannon. The 1877 letter indicated that even the patriarchs had become infected with the values of the larger society. Elder Taylor said, "It has appeared to several members of the quorum that they have noticed a spirit among some of the brethren ordained to that office of patriarch to degrade it as a mere means of obtaining a livelihood. And to obtain more business, they had been traveling from door to door and underbidding each other in the price of blessings." This we all consider an evil, and that it should be remedied as soon as possible. The remedy suggested was that a quorum of patriarchs be organized, over which Patriarch John Smith, by virtue of his calling, will preside. Then in the year 1914, the direction to local patriarchs was, "You may accept a gift if it is offered, but do not permit anyone you have blessed to leave your presence feeling they have paid for a blessing. Patriarchal blessings cannot be purchased. They are the free gifts of God to his children under the hands of patriarchs." This advice was repeated many times through the years, but then in 1943, an official statement to the patriarchs said that the acceptance of any gratuity was to be officially condemned. Procedures for obtaining blessings have changed too. In the early days, when there was an easy familiarity within the Mormon communities, anyone could get a blessing, and even some non-members received them. Colonel Thomas Paine is perhaps the most famous of these. Friend of the Mormons, he requested a blessing and received one from John Smith, Uncle John Smith. Several blessings during the days of Joseph Smith Sr. were given to non-members, some of whom subsequently joined the church. Today, with the geographic and numerical expansion of the church, blessings are restricted to members in good standing. Beginning with Patriarch Hiram G. Smith in the 1920s, the instruction to local patriarchs was to bless the worthy members of your stake. Then, from early 1932, members of the church were required to obtain recommends from their bishop and stake president, attesting to their worthiness. But there were other changes too, and there isn't time to go into them. But there were changes made largely for institutional reasons. I'd like to conclude by making three general observations. The first is about change itself. Some Mormons, despite our belief in continuous revelation, are uncomfortable with the evidence of cultural change and its effect upon the church. Revelation is revelation to them, and it is not tied to cultural context. Several of our church leaders have condemned contextual history, including our prophet, present prophet. Yet to me it seems perfectly natural that patriarchal blessings would reflect the culture in which they were given, not only from the point of view of the man giving it, but from the standpoint of those receiving them. It is hardly likely that any man can escape the particular worldview of his time, those unquestioned presuppositions that govern our thoughts and our actions in everyday life. And I believe otherworldly beliefs are a part of that day-to-day experience. I have a difficult time with much of the Old Testament, beautiful as it is in many ways, until I recognize that they lived in another world, socially, economically, and religiously. I think we have to recognize that same thing about our 19th century Mormon forebears. For instance, we have to recognize the dire straits of the early saints as they faced their world. Just as workers during the Industrial Revolution turned to heavenly rewards as an assurance that there was more to existence than this life of suffering, so the early saints needed that comfort. Those 19th century patriarchal blessings must have provided hope and sustained their faith. And in fact, the comfort gained from them is referred to many, many times in journals. Second, excuse me, how can we deal with the unfulfilled promises in those early blessings? Certainly those who were told they would escape death have not lived to tell the tale, and we are still awaiting the advent of the Savior, and so on. Historical context does allow somewhat for those things, and it lets us off the hook to some extent, because so often we impute an underlying unrighteousness that prevented the realization of those promises. But it does raise some other questions. For example, how much credence can we give to the blessings we are receiving today? Well, let me tell you, 20th century blessings are on much safer ground. They deal less in prophecy. In fact, the patriarchs have been warned specifically not to make extravagant promises. They dwell more on present challenges. They illuminate personal strengths and, in rare instances, on weaknesses. They also tell us much of what we know already. They also give us some kind of faith-promoting instance of how we ourselves are part of this whole picture. So there's nothing that we can refute, in a way. They encourage us to support institutional programs, and what safer ground is that? Finally, though, I do have to say I have been deeply moved by the faith of those early saints. I think sometimes we are so earthbound today and so literal in our responses that we need and seek certainty, instead of simply being aware of the gift of comfort and the reassurance of God's love. When I read the flowery phrases of some of those early blessings and some of those promises, and see them within the context of the primitive living conditions of the early saints that they were forced to endure so much, when I think of the lack of security, the sickness and the persecution, and the constant struggle to survive economically, I'm overwhelmed by an awareness of what such beauty might have meant in the lives of those saints. And when I ask what I would long to hear in a patriarchal blessing, then I believe the same essential message would be welcome. I want only to know, I don't want prophecies, I want only to know that God is with me in all of my searchings, that he recognizes my aching need for truth, and that he cares about me, and that he understands my 20th century pain as well as my deepest joy. What shape the blessings assumes in terms of language or specifics is less important than that central spiritual expression of God's love. And I'm left with just one question, and I'm not going to answer it. I'd leave it to you to answer for yourselves. Why do we need a patriarchal blessing for that kind of assurance? Thank you.
I wanted to start just by thanking Irene for letting me read her paper. Patriarchal blessings have always been really fascinating to me, partly probably because I don't know very much about them. My parents are both converts and my husband isn't Mormon, so the only blessings I've ever gotten to read before I got to read this paper were my sister's and mine. So this was a very interesting paper for me, both in the breadth of the blessings and in the depth, in tracing back the history. Like Irene, I see a lot of I see a lot of the same patterns that she talks about. Oh, so this is a disclaimer here. All the evidence that I'm using is from her paper, so if it's wrong, it's her fault. I see the same patterns that she talks about, and I see the same changes. In critiquing or responding to her paper, I'd like to take a slightly different approach. She sees the evolution, if I'm not mistaken, as being as much a reflection of the church's response to the external culture of American history in particular. And there are several points in the paper where she talks about changes in the church being linked to these outside influences. Capitalism is particularly strong, this happens, or there are lots of things with millennialism, which is very much in tune with the American thing, and that the changes that have been taking place have been as a church wants to become more accepted in this larger culture. What I would like to look at instead is looking at the church as a culture within itself that's changing much in the way that an individual changes, both in response to an external culture, but also just as an individual develops. If you think about the way an individual develops in society, I would argue that it's not only shaped by external things, but that every individual in his or her development has parallel growth to other people. With that sort of as my basis, what I would like to specifically argue is that... or draw parallels to, is the early Mormon culture that she discusses with these early blessings and the early Christian church that we find in the New Testament. Because I would argue that many of the things that she's discussing we find not just in America at that time, but in the New Testament. And I think it's interesting to see in the evolution from an Old Testament orientation to a New Testament orientation, that's how I would see the evolution of the blessings that she discusses. Okay, the early New Testament people were coming out of an Old Testament situation that was very patriarchal, and in which the thing that I see most of all in the Old Testament is that whenever there's a spiritual truth taught, it becomes externally embodied. When the children of Israel were obedient, they got manna. When they were disobedient, they starved. When they were righteous, they received external physical prosperity. When they were unrighteous, they lost their wars. Their royalty had specific bloodlines that they could trace all the way back to Adam. And their royalty were royalty. They were King David, kings on the scale of Solomon. The reason that Jews have refused to accept Jesus as Christ is because he doesn't fit the prophecies. They just cannot bring themselves to believe that the Son of God would be born in a stable because it didn't happen that way before. They were waiting for a new Moses that will deliver them. And instead they got, you know, this like carpenter who says, well, the way to win is to not fight, is to turn the other cheek. When you're reading the prophecies in the Old Testament about the Messiah, they just don't fit with what happened at first. When you first read them, you think these weren't fulfilled. There wasn't a great prince coming in power. There wasn't prosperity and riches. It didn't happen that way. Until you begin to realize that God is, or that Christ in the New Testament, is forcing the Jews to redefine their terms. it's not that it goes from being literal to figurative, it's that it goes from being literal to literal, that they're redefining what Prince of Peace means, what the Son of God means. Okay, that seems like a digression, but it's not, because what I'm arguing is that the early blessings of the church, like the early Christians, are struggling with these kind of literal, external embodiment kinds of promises, while they're entering into being forced to rejudge how those prophecies are going to be fulfilled. Let me be specific in how they're grappling with the effects of emerging from this patriarchal, very external culture. The examples that Irene uses that I'd just like to go down the list for, the first one is she talks about lineage. That's a big thing in the Old Testament. It's important to know where you came from. Well, the New Testament starts out in the same way. The first thing we get in Matthew is a lineage of Christ. We also get it in Luke, but I'll talk more about that in a minute. The millennium, she talks about the idea of an imminent millennium is being very typical of America, in America at that time. It is also that this is what was going on in the early church. The apostles were living with Christ. The book of Acts begins with his ascension. And as they're standing there looking up in heaven, these two men in white say to them, "Why are you looking up in heaven? He's going to come back." They thought they meant within the week, within the year, definitely within their lifetimes. And when Paul says to the saints, "He's coming soon," he assumed, like the early Mormons assumed, that it was going to be any minute, if not any day. So that's another link, the idea of lineage, the idea of millennium. Another link is the idea of enemies, both in the early church and in early Mormonism, in the early Christian church and the early Mormon church. They were fighting very hard to defend the church from very real physical enemies, who were threatening their very survival. And there's a lot of talk, I mean, the Onward Christian Soldiers stuff comes from this, because they had to defend what they had. Many of the New Testament scriptures, like these early patriarchal blessings, talk about fighting for the Lord, talk about swords, talk about blood, all that violent stuff. Another way in which are similar is that, again, these external gifts that they have, they can that Irene mentioned, they have healing handkerchiefs, they can move mountains, they can create floods, all kinds, you know, speaking in tongues. None of this goes on anymore, but it was, well, maybe it does, not in my life, but a huge just outpouring of this that I find really parallel, not just, you know, coming out of the milieu of the upstate New York religious ferment, but also that it links it back to this earlier thing. And sort of is a subset of that, the idea of translation, that you'll be translated. We're told that a couple of disciples were translated. Okay, so the way that I see it evolving in the later blessings that Irene showed us is not just the church becoming more sensitive to the outer culture and wanting to become more inoffensive and more conciliatory, but I really see an evolution within the church itself that closely parallels what happens in the New Testament as the early Christians begin to realize that these things are not going to be fulfilled in the way they thought they were going to be any more than the Old Testament prophecies were about Christ were fulfilled in the way they thought they would be. So, for instance, and I'll just run through these because it's getting repetitious, but the lineage, you know, which seems like in Matthew brings Christ back to Adam, and that's great. Well, two books later in Luke, you get a lineage that's fine, Abraham through David, and then splits at David. One of them traces it through Solomon, and the other one starts tracing it through Nathan. Well, you can come up with all kinds of elaborate justifications, but this is not the sort of lineage that you can use for blood types or something. It doesn't work. It's not literal. It's not physical anymore. You say, what is it for? Well, what Irene has pointed out is that lineage is important not so much as the tracing of bloodlines, because they just get too confused. You can't do it that way anymore. But as a tracing of the blessings. That shift in emphasis, I don't see just for safety in terms of the millennium anymore. But also, I think that there's a growing realization that it's an internal thing as much as an external thing. That when you're talking in these early blessings about seeing the face of Christ, about seeing the winding up scenes of your generation, we're assuming that that was an external second coming. But what both the early Mormons and the early Christians began to realize is that you were probably going to see Christ yourself individually and personally before the whole world saw him. That the second coming shifts in emphasis to a spiritual return of Christ in an individual's life instead of this external Old Testament sort of thing, which is not to say that this big second coming is not going to return, but that the emphasis shifts to the internal instead of the external. Same with enemies, the fighting shifts from this embodiment of evil people, you know, that you can kill with your swords, to struggling more personally against sort of individual demons and devils and Satan and temptations and things like that. In the same way that gifts shift from things like tongues and miracles and moving mountains around to spiritual gifts that are no less profound, but are more internal. Things like compassion, things like faith. Things like healing that maybe don't mean like draping your handkerchief over someone's face, but maybe have more to do with healing someone's soul. I'm kind of running out of time, so I'll cut my... No, I won't. I'll just do it really quickly. In Matthew, when Christ is being crucified, this is just one of my favorite parts. There's a part where Christ is being crucified, and he's surrounded by Jews, and they are going through a checklist and showing him how he doesn't fit the prophecies, okay? And first they say, all right, if you who are will destroy and then build up the temple in 3 days, save yourself. And then they laugh for a while. And then they say, and it's really brutal, because in Matthew's version, even the thieves who are being crucified with him are making fun of him. And then they say, if you are the Son of God, get down off the cross. Because that's, you know, Son of God to them meant Moses, Abraham, big, powerful people. And they were waiting for him to do this. Then they said, he can save other people himself, he cannot save. Christ's only reaction to this after putting up with it for a while was that, you know, famous cry of anguish, which I'm going to try to read in Hebrew, but... My husband, even though he's Jewish, is really secular and never went to Hebrew school, so couldn't really help me out with the pronunciation. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Well, they had a heyday, and they said, see, this proves that he's not God. Well, what they didn't realize is he is quoting the very first verse of the 22nd chapter of Psalms, which is a messianic psalm talking about the Messiah and talking about the pain he will undergo. So what they were taking as proof that nothing had been fulfilled, that this wasn't God, was the very thing that was fulfilling the prophecy. Okay, I did it pretty quickly. In light of this and this sort of reading, in the same way that when we go back and reread the Old Testament in light of the New Testament, which forces us to consider that maybe things are being fulfilled in ways that we didn't think they would be. And I'm not saying that they're not being literally fulfilled, but that we have to get rid of our cultural preconceptions about what it means for these things to be fulfilled. I would like to go back and just look very briefly at a couple of the examples of blessings that she gave us. I'll just make reference to some of them. The enemies, if you're thinking about these in terms of internal enemies instead of external enemies, the idea of using the sword of Laban and treading down your enemies does not seem quite as absurd. Specifically, when they're talking about the millennium... Oh, dear, I can't find this. Okay, here we go. Well, I can't find the part about the millennium. But when it talks about how you will be a witness to the winding up scene of your generation, we automatically assume that means millennium, right? But what does that mean? I mean, what does it mean to tell someone that he will see the final winding up scene of his generation? I think that we're automatically ascribing, you know, external millennial readings onto that. The final examples that I wanted to use were the specific ones on translation, particularly the one where the person was told, "You shall not taste of death, but shall be changed in the twinkling of an eye." I would like to argue that while we immediately assume that means physical translation, boom, just like the disciples, that could very literally be true in any number of cases, because all that it's saying is that he won't or she won't be conscious of death. You shall not taste of death, but shall be changed in the twinkling of an eye. Maybe, this is a big maybe, it means they won't, you know, it will be a sudden death. Now, I don't know for sure. I haven't done the research. Maybe this person died of a long and lingering illness. My friend suggested leprosy. I said, thank you, Ginger. But the purpose of this is not to say, well, see, every single thing came true. It really did come true. I promise it did, and if you just give me enough time, I can come up with justifications for every single one. Because I don't think you can, and I don't think that that's the point. But I do take issue with Irene's argument that these are primarily for comfort. I don't think that these are just for comfort. I don't think that you can dismiss these blessings in terms of how they were fulfilled. I think that is the lesson that the New Testament teaches us regarding the Old Testament. And I know in my life, and from what I hear in Sunday school classes and Relief Society, I think in most Mormons' lives, prophecies, promises are never fulfilled the way that you think they will be. But when you look back, often they have been fulfilled. And often it was more literally than you thought it would be. You get a patriarchal blessing and it says, you and your husband will have a deep love. And you're 15 years old and you think, constant source of joy, roses every Friday night, and it doesn't work out that way. But when you look back, and I think that's the reason our patriarchal blessings are written down, so that when we look back, we're forced to strip away and say, oh, it didn't say what I thought it said. It just said that, and that part came out to be true. So I'm not saying that you can't take them literally. I'm just saying that we must suspend our preconceptions about how these are going to be fulfilled and how important it is that they are fulfilled in the same way that Jesus forced the people in the New Testament to re-question how they were going to look at this. Just in closing, I would like to close by re-quoting something that I was very moved by. It was one of the blessings that Irene referred to. When a woman who probably was dealing with polygamy was told, "The devil has sought to ensnare thee and bind thy soul fast, and because of strange questions that have arisen, thy spirit has been troubled. But the purpose of God cannot fail, and the time shall come when thou shalt see it and understand it, and thy soul shall be comforted." It's important to me as I reread this that it doesn't say, like I thought it did on first reading, that the devil is ensnaring her by giving her strange questions. It says she has strange questions. It also says that the devil is trying to ensnare her. My reading of it is that he's trying to ensnare her by having her stop in her process of questioning. Because the assurance is that at the end, these strange questions, which I think we are given to work through, will be answered. Because of strange questions that have arisen, thy spirit has been troubled, but the purpose of God cannot fail. And the time shall come when thou shalt see it and understand it, and thy soul shall be comforted. Again, thank you, Irene, for giving me this paper. I see the same changes she sees, but I think it's really important that we face the questions when things don't seem to work out, but know that in the end we will understand how these things work or don't work.
I'd just like to say that I love Heather's interpretation of that blessing, the one about the devil ensnaring. I hadn't thought of that, and I think that is so beautiful that that the devil would ensnare her not to ask questions. I think that's beautiful. Two of me too. But I agree with her about the Old Testament parallel with the New Testament, the New Christian parallel. Because in the expanded version of this, this is something I deal with, the fact that the office of patriarch itself is an Old Testament concept. And the early days of the church was absolutely full of reference to the Old Testament as well as the New. And it's this growing away from that has produced many of these things as well. The same applies to the larger society too. The gentleman asked how we can get hold of our ancestors' patriarchal blessing. If you can prove that you are a blood relation of your ancestor, then you can apply for a copy. You have to fill a form in, and they will send you a copy.
In the church,
well, I think you can write, but you can go in and just go into the church historical department. They have all the blessings there.
They charge
for it. I think so.
Last time I tried that, it was limited to 3 or 4 generations.
Oh, were you? Well, that's a new one.
How are you
doing? Through journals, through references in other works, and through soliciting them. Yes. The question was, did I read the letters of George P. Lee before his excommunication? Yes, I did. Lady asked me to comment on this question of lineage as it relates to race. One of the problems has been that there has been disagreement among the authorities of the church as to whether lineage is of blood or of blessing. And in fact, there have been those who say that when you become a member of the church, then your blood is literally changed so that you become part of that tribe. I think that's dying out, but there has been some real serious consideration of that fact. One interesting thing that Lester Bush pointed out, though, in relation to that, and I think this is funny, he wondered, when they were talking about before the 1978 revelation, that some members of the church received blood transfusions and received them from black people, so that for a short period of time they would have that blood in their being, and did this disqualify them, you know? Oh, yes. Yeah.
You didn't understand, of course, the genetics.
No. And that's one of the things that when Heather was talking about our reaction in the larger society, I didn't mean to imply that it was just reacting to. I meant that further knowledge that we have, even in the church as well as outside of it, has changed a lot of our perceptions. Yes. I don't know that one.
But I wanted to ask you, when the idea that there was one patriarchal
Well,
I noticed in going to the patriarchal blessing index looking for my own family, which is Christian, and there's a lot of Jewish family
Did all of you hear that? She wanted to know when the practice of just having single blessings came about. Well, President Heber J. Grant had 6 blessings. And this was a common practice. People went to blessings for comfort. They would go to blessings for a reaffirmation of their faith. They would go for blessings even for healing. So they would go for any number of things. And then in, I think it was Hiram G. Smith, who served from 1912 to 1932, he discouraged that. And then it became more officially condemned, not condemned, but discouraged, that one blessing was enough. And Eldred G. Smith gave a talk in which he said that one blessing was enough, that we didn't need to go for all these others.
Do you have any observations about the position of church patriarchs today that no longer sustain the prophecy and revelation?
I'm writing a dissertation about that, and it's been a very interesting evolution of my own thought on the subject, because I started off by thinking that there was somewhat of a paranoia about the claims of a hereditary office, that, you know, obviously the reorganized church has promoted that, but that there has been constantly a sense of threat. I no longer feel that that's central. I think it's still part of it, but I think that the real answer to that question is that it was inevitable, that a hereditary office that does not fit the kind of institution, a worldwide institution, because of its lack of predictability in who occupies the office. So that I think it's inherent, and I think it was inevitable. Yes?
No one holds the position
right now. No, it was made emeritus in 1979. I'm sorry, I can't. That's a good question. I've talked to a number of local patriarchs who feel like motherless children. They feel that they officially go to the state president now. It was the general authorities. They go to the state president who, if he can't answer, will go to a general authority. But there's no one that is an expert, if you like. So they do feel, some of them feel like that. Yes.
Maybe an extension on that, you might want to comment on the fact that they do study patriarchal blessings and they are given direction.
Well, yes, they're all given a direction when they're, well, very, very, it's not very comprehensive at all. And they do study patriarchal blessings, but you'd be amazed at the letters that I have read addressed to Hiram G. Smith, who acted very specifically as a presiding patriarch. He was very efficient and very very caring. Those letters have some very interesting questions, and I wonder where those questions go now, because it would be very difficult for anyone who was not working in that to answer them.
Well, I had heard that, at least what I understand from the other source, that actually the patriarchs now are looked into very closely in their work, their blessings are reviewed, and if there are things being said or discussing those blessings that are not appropriate for current church policy and teaching, they're admonished about that, and if not, if they don't follow that, maybe they're followed through.
Yeah, that's true. The presiding patriarch used to do quite a bit of that, reviewing patriarchal blessings, but now the state president is allowed to do that, and also visiting general authorities. And yes, you're right, there is some. And they do get these specific directions that they are not to make extravagant promises and prophecies, that they are to deal with the life of the individual.
When you say they review patriarchal blessings as part of their training, what is that? They have a sample?
Well, all patriarchal blessings are kept in the church historian's office. At one time, there was a patriarchal blessing book, in fact. I think somebody here had access to... you can't have access to those books. But I have the patriarchal blessing, copy of the patriarchal blessing book of William Smith, 200 blessings in that one. And presumably there is a filing system, and I suppose it's a spot check.
They are given samples.
Pardon?
They are given sample blessings.
Yeah, yes, but in light of Brother Grosbeck's comment, the checking on the performance of patriarchs, I'm sure maybe is different. You know, you're talking about current patriarchs having access as examples, aren't you? Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering, is it true? I've heard that there's some patriarchal blessings that dealt with Keith Smith having his own private file that he hasn't turned over to the church. Is that
true? I don't know.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to break it off. There's another session that wants to come in the room. Thank you very much to our two speakers.